So what does wellness mean to you? Welcome to Wellness Wednesdays. I'm your host, Eric Lard. This week, another special episode live from downtown Halifax, the Cyclone Fitness Studio. We've got a special guest, someone I've known for a few years, yoga instructor, not-for-profit co-founder. She's kind of done it all. She's young in years, but she's got an old soul. Welcome to podcast, Laurel. Thanks for making time.
Thanks for having me.
So we'll get right into the yoga piece. We've actually done a couple workshops together over the years. I really like how you approach yoga, and even though you're not a huge runner, you still kind of get out there once in a while and try to approach running the yoga way, which is kind of what we talked about. But how did you get into yoga? Can you give us kind of a little bit of backstory?
Yeah, how did I get into yoga? So the very first yoga class that I went to was like a power Ashtanga vinyasa class that was not meant for beginners. And it was so freaking hard. I think it was an hour and a half. By the end of the hour and a half, I thought I was just going to die. And so that wasn't the best way to start for me.
Sorry to interrupt a few times. That's one thing I find with yoga. Like, they don't come with, like, warnings.
No.
And most of the time, like, you don't really, as a beginner, you don't know the difference between Ashtanga and, like, yin. Like, you have no clue. Like, you're like, they both sound foreign to me. Like, they're the same thing, so.
Totally, yeah. And you kind of have this perspective that, like, yoga is yoga is yoga. And I totally had that at the beginning of when I started practicing. At the time, I was living in Ottawa. Yeah. And I had started going to Rama Lotus, which is kind of like the staple yoga center in Ottawa. I think it was one of the first ones that had opened.
Been around for quite some time.
And I remember just showing up to any old class thinking it would be the same, and then heading to a Bikram class. And then really thinking, like, wow, that first one that I went to that I thought was hard is not hard anymore. And then the guy was kind of like...
Ed Hum, yeah, probably.
It was Ed, He was like...
The monotone man.
You know, very auctioneer style, like very kind of drill sergeant. So that was a rude awakening. But when I first started, and once I kind of got into the groove of what I actually did like to practice, which wasn't as intense as Bikram... but it was Ashtanga, and I did like Ashtanga quite a bit. And when I took my training, it was partially led by an Ashtanga practitioner. But I started in Ottawa. I think I practiced for about 2 or 3 years before I decided to take a training. And for me, it was really transformational at that period in time. I don't think I really recognized it at the time, but I was going through a pretty severe eating disorder where actually I was 50 pounds less than what I am now.
Wow. So I don't think I knew you back then. So.
You didn't? No. So for those of you that are listening, I'm 6 feet tall, and at the time I was 128 pounds.
Wow. Yeah.
So when I look back on pictures of myself, I can really see the difference, right?
And then when you're funny, because when I think of you, I think of like a healthy lady. Like, it's just it's funny how, like, and you don't judge someone until you walk them out in their shoes, right?
Yeah. And you know, and that's the thing too about eating disorders, is that it can really hit anybody. And you know, I had a great childhood and great parents and great social circle and all that stuff, and I had some struggles with weight when I was younger, and I think that really kind of played into it. But yoga was really the modality that for me really started to heal that way of thinking, and just being mindful of my thoughts and realizing how damaging my thoughts had been during that period of time. So it really quickly became more than stretching and more than fitness, and more of a spiritual transformative practice.
Very cool. That's awesome. And it's funny, like, and the same thing with running. I mean, whatever your activity of choice, could be cycling, could be playing hockey, could be, you know, knitting, whatever. Like, it's so therapeutic. And that's why people, I kind of feel bad for some folks that don't have that, especially something active. I find that really gets the mind going in a good way. Like, and so for me, it's mostly been running, but I've been practicing yoga, obviously not to your level, but I've been practicing yoga for almost 12 years now. Like, you know, not every single day, but on a semi-regular basis. And yoga's helped a lot, but like, running's probably been the more transformative one for me. But yeah, like, that's what I love talking about, people like about like their experience, because it's you're like, wow, like I didn't even know about the eating disorder. So it's and it's probably not the funnest thing to share, but I appreciate you sharing that. So, and then how do you go from being, obviously being transformed is a cool thing, but like how do you go from being a student to now being a teacher? Like that's I've done that in a couple different sports and it's different.
Yeah, it's tough. There's definitely days where, especially as a younger teacher, I'm 27 right now. There's definitely days where, you know, like everybody, I have my doubts and I'm kind of thinking like, maybe I'm too young to be teaching these people. Maybe I don't have enough experience. But really, you know, I've done a lot of trainings. What I try to bring to my classes is that space where people can be with their body, kind of recognize any tendencies that they have. So if, you know, if there's someone that tends to work at 120% all the time, then maybe it's a space where they can kind of back down and work at 80%, right? But what I try to bring to my classes is a space where people can just come be with their bodies, get a little bit of mindfulness in, and really, when I teach yoga and I teach other fitness classes, but really my yoga classes are a little more mellow than everything else that I teach. Because I think, you know, we have a lot of demands happening in our lives outside of fitness, outside of yoga, just in
really?
Work and things like that.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
Myself included.
Yeah.
And yeah, for me, my yoga practice is a little more mellow. So even when I am practicing Ashtanga, which is a little more intense, obviously, I'm not doing it very fast. I'm being more intentional with it. But yeah, it's tough to go from being a student to a teacher. And I think, too, if you surveyed 100 yoga teachers, they would probably all give you at least one thing in common, which is when you're teaching, you are also learning so much from your students. Because when you show up at the front of the class, wherever you are, you have to walk the walk, right? You can't just say, you know, love yourself, namaste, you know, love and light, peace, it's all good, and internally not really feel that. So when I come...
Well, you can. Some people do that, but then...
I guess you
know,
can.
Yeah,
it's true. Some people
fraud,
do that.
Yeah.
But for me, it's like, okay, I'm not saying anything that I don't actually believe. So, you know, if I'm not feeling it that day, then I won't say... you know, go on this long diatribe of whatever, but it really does make me, you know, really think back and step back and say, I have to walk the walk here if I'm going to be up here. So.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, even I've been teaching running for probably 8 years and I've been, you know, I've taught just a little more than 1,000 people. So as a running instructor, I think I'm fairly advanced, like, and I'm using quotation marks right now, but so it's like I'm older, and so, but I did a course recently with the special ops folks from the Canadian Forces. I was intimidated. I was like,
yeah.
And like, I was like, wow, these people know what they're doing. And like, you know, like this is like hardcore stuff. And then, but
yeah,
it turned out to be a class like every other class, 'cause they're coming to the efficient running style. Most of them had no clue. I mean, they were incredible athletes and incredible, but they had no clue about their running form and stuff. So you're right. Like every time you teach, you learn something new. And that's why I loved, even though I've been teaching the same thing more or less for the last, you know, 10 years or so, like every time I teach, it's something different. It gets new people. Mm-hmm. I learn something a little different. And so it still keeps me kind of fresh. And it's a good thing, too. And I think it's the same thing with you. Like, I don't teach 40 hours a week. Like, I do teach a lot of different stuff, but it keeps me fresh because I've got a bit of ADD. So I couldn't do, like, I couldn't teach running every single day. Like, I would get kind of bored. So.
Right.
Yeah. And I know you teach. What do you teach other than yoga?
So right now I teach yoga. My second certification that I did after my yoga training was kettlebell. Kettlebell also kind of was this like by accident love that I had when I was living in Ottawa. I ended up living on the same block as a kettlebell studio called Fitness Fusion. In the Byward Market, and just by chance I had went there and went, oh, you know, I'm doing my yoga teacher training, I'm super strong, this is going to be great. And the first class I went to, I realized that like I was like Gumby, like I was a noodle. I had so much flexibility but not the strength to balance it. And I really liked, you know, everything that I really tend to enjoy are things that are individual. I've never been a team I'm a team player in other aspects, but not a team player when it comes to sports and things like that. So I liked that it was a very individual thing that you can do with other people around you. And there's that kind of social aspect, but no one's like relying on me to catch the ball because that wouldn't go over really well. So I also teach kettlebell. I also teach bar. And I just recently started teaching indoor cycling and spin. So those are my four.
And where did you take your certification for kettlebell?
I took my certification for kettlebell in Prince Edward Island.
Oh, yes. It was with my friend.
With Wendy, her studio. So I was there doing the research for my master's at the time. And then it just so happened that she was bringing in Ajamu. Just a super small world.
Small world, yeah.
Super small world.
For those that at home that don't know a small world, so I actually taught a workshop at Wendy's studio in PEI probably 4 years ago or something. And then I think I connected you you ladies, and then, I love when that stuff happens. So is staying on the yoga beat for a little bit, what is your current practice like? Because you talk about walking the walk. How often do you practice? And I'm not putting you on a spot, but it's just like, just so people, because a lot of people, they're like, okay, I like yoga, but I'm not a yoga instructor because I don't practice every day. But I know some yoga practitioners or teachers don't practice every day either. So what's like, and I know it's a big part of your life, but what would be a typical week in the yoga life of Laurel?
Every person's different. Every yoga student, if you're just into yoga, or if you're a teacher, everyone's kind of got their own rhythm and groove that works for them. For me personally, I try to practice, I would say like 4 or 5 times a week. And that practice might look really different depending on the day and depending on what's going on in my life. At the very beginning, when I first started practicing and first started teaching, I was like, I'm going to wake up at, X hour in the morning
4
before the sun comes up and do this really intense Ashtanga practice every morning, go to Mysore, and, that's going to be the schedule. And I was miserable. I just couldn't do it. Every night I'd get to going to bed, I'd be like, oh, I got to go to Mysore in the morning. Finally, someone was like, why are you doing it? Like, you're not enjoying it. Like, do a practice that you enjoy, right? If you're dreading it. So that was a big one for me. So I try to be consistent, but at the same time, I know my personal tendency is to strive for perfection, which is a big reason why I had that eating disorder in the first place, which was a manifestation of that. So if I don't get on my mat every day and I end up going for a walk outside, or I end up, just reading a book or spending time by the water, that's okay. I've like become okay with that. That's not to say that every day I just skip my practice and don't practice ever. My practice can kind of evolve, and if it doesn't happen every day, then that's fine. And so, I try to just be kind of gentle with myself in that aspect. That being said, I do like to have at least one pretty long practice a week at minimum. So like an hour and a half once a week at minimum. But other days it might just be like 20 minutes, half hour. And depending on how I'm feeling that day or what time of the day it is, it might be a little more intense, a little more fiery. It might be like, I just really need to tone it down here and just kind of do some restorative poses or some yin poses. So I try to listen to my body and at the same time sort of balance it with, what I'm kind of wanting to do and what I know would be best for me. So if I'm feeling really, if I'm feeling really tired and really lethargic and really sloth-like, it's probably going to make me feel even more like that if I do a yin practice. So I know in that case, it might be good for me to move a little bit. So I try to take that into account.
That's awesome. I think that awareness piece is huge, whether it's running, whether it's yoga, whether it's cycling or bar or whatever. I've never done bar, but it looks pretty cool.
It's a good complement to everything else.
You mentioned the water. We'll just kind of touch on that before we move on to something else. And it's something that, unless you live by the water, it's not, I don't think most people talk about that. But like last night, for example, I had waves on my device playing while I fell asleep. So therapeutic. Mm-hmm. How do you find that, or water for therapy for you, how is that? And I know it is, but like, I just want you to put into words on, because I know you love, every time we talk, we somehow end up talking about water.
It's true. Yeah. Last time you came to visit, we ended up talking about the big swim from Nova Scotia to PEI and how we might try to do that together. For the listeners right now, I live on the ocean in this really cool spot that we're just renting right now. But I feel like once you live on the ocean or on the lake or on a river or whatever it is, it's really hard to go back from that.
What is it? What is it about the water? Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It just feels like
this. Because it's a big part of your wellness. Because every time we talk about most of the time water comes up. Like, and it's not like, it just happens. So it's just a cool thing that.
It's been this really big part of my life for a really long time. I've always been into swimming. Even when I was younger and not very athletic and, you know, didn't really feel, you know, I was a little overweight when I was a kid. Swimming was always something that I was like, F it, I'm going swimming. Yeah. Doesn't matter what everyone else thinks. Like, this is something that I'm going to do.
You go girl? Yeah.
Exactly. I don't know. I think one memory is coming to mind, and that was a couple years ago. I went to Costa Rica, and I was going through a rough time in my personal life, and we went to Nosara, and the waves in Nosara are just constant. When you go in the ocean, the waves are just constant and constant and constant, and I remember going into the water and feeling the waves, like, crash onto me, and feeling like every time a wave like came over me that it was just like taking the stress, taking the negativity, like all of that was just being washed out.
That's amazing.
Into the ocean. I think it doesn't matter who you talk with, that humans have this connection to water, that obviously we need it to survive, so there's that element. But just this kind of really long story, almost like mythical relationship where it is a source of healing and a source of strength and renewal. I don't know. It's hard to put into words.
Yeah.
It's definitely hard to put into words, but.
And I think that's why, like, whenever I come out to Halifax, it's such a, like, as soon as you land, like, you can smell, like, kind of the salt water in the air, and it's like, I usually teach at Point Pleasant Park, which is a beautiful spot right on the water. And it's and even last night I was at Salt Marsh Trail, which is incredible. And it is very therapeutic. And you're right, like, it's hard to kind of, exactly. But it's like, even last night was so calming. There was no waves, but it's still like just a little bit of wind. And then like, and just seeing water as far as you can see, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think, like, for me, when you go, especially in Halifax, when you go to the ocean and it's ocean for as far as the eye can see, it also is sort of akin to like looking up at the stars and just sort of realizing like my problems are just a small piece of this equation and really not a big deal in the long grand scheme of things. And same thing with looking out at the ocean, right? Like you're just this small part of this really massive, astounding planet. And now I'm sounding more like the hippy-dippy yoga teacher that I really am. But, you know, just having that perspective and being like, is what I'm really upset or thinking about right now really, you know, am I going to be thinking about it in a week, in a year, in 10 years? Probably not. So it has that really nice perspective.
Yeah, and so it's very needed sometimes, especially in busy lives, like sometimes we kind of, it's very easy to lose perspective. So it's nice to be able to have that ocean or the sound machine or whatever, it gets you back to just kind of relaxing. We're going to switch lanes a little bit here and go back to your schooling, like kind of what brought you out here. Can you give people an idea of like what you do, and then we'll get into the not-for-profit that you founded? Because you're all about the environment, and it's not going to be all hippy dippy. But what are the cool stuff that you're working on now?
Yeah, I moved to Halifax. I guess it was almost 4 years ago.
Oh, that long ago.
Yeah. I know. To do my master's at Dal, so I did my master's in environmental studies, and I focused on pollination, and particularly like relating to food security and food availability. And it's a really, no one wants to hear the full, you know, details of anybody's thesis work because it kind of makes your eyes glaze over. But
are we all screwed?
We're not all screwed.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
There's
that's
hope.
Kinda, there's hope.
Okay.
There's
good.
Hope.
Good.
So that's why I came out here, and I've always been really interested, and finally, and it ties back to what we were talking about earlier, I've always been really interested in food, because I've had this, and everyone has their own story with food, obviously, no matter who you talk to, there's that culture around food, or their personal relationship with food. Is food good? Is food bad? What is good? What is
Food's
bad?
Food's almost like a religion. Like, if you talk to someone about that loves carbs and you tell them carbs are bad, they're like, no, they're not. It's I'm not saying Donald Trump is the man. Like, relax.
So I've always been really interested in food, and that sort of translated into, like, food security, food sovereignty, food availability.
And what does that mean for the people at home? Because I don't think most people understand what food security means.
Food security is having access to food that is nutritious and culturally appropriate. So, you know, you might be in a place where if you're food insecure, you don't have access to food, period. Right, so in places where they've experienced famine or drought, they are definitely in a food insecure region. Food sovereignty is having the ability to choose what food you want to consume. So food, an example of that would be when I go to the grocery store and there's, you know, an apple from Argentina and an apple from Australia and an apple from Nova Scotia, I have the financial means to have food sovereignty in that case and say, you know what, I want to buy the apple from Nova Scotia because it's local, or I want to buy the apple from Australia because it's organic, or whatever. So I've made a choice there, and that is me enacting food sovereignty. And, you know, we have to recognize that not everyone has that privilege and that choice, right? It might just be like, I'm eating this because that's what's available, that's what's affordable to me, and I don't have the choice of what's organic or what's local or what's the latest trend, gluten-free, what vegan, whatever. So I've always been really interested in that, and I think because I've had this really long relationship with food, and I think it's always going to be there a little bit, but I've mostly kind of healed that relationship. But when I moved to Halifax to start my master's, I had been living in Ottawa, and there's an organization in Ottawa called Hidden Harvest Ottawa. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they collect fruit. So throughout the city on public and private land. And when I moved to Halifax, like, and you've now been to Halifax a bunch of times, Halifax is like all about I love local. Like, that's literally, we have bumper stickers that say I heart local.
Yeah.
Very much into supporting local producers and local seafood and going to the market. Like, if you go to the market on Saturday morning, you'll see everybody and their dog, literally. Like, you'll meet everyone you know.
Yeah.
So when I moved, I was like, it's so funny that nothing like that exists in Halifax yet, because I feel like just the market, the climate, the people would just be into it, right? It's just like kind of this natural fit. So I had met another woman through my master's, her name's Lindsay, and we started talking about this. She's also really into agricultural production and things like that.
Is she from here?
She is from Maine, so we are both quote unquote come from away-ers, which is a slogan here in Nova Scotia. If your grandfather's grandfather wasn't born in Nova Scotia, then you're a come from away-er.
Okay.
But I think too, it kind of gave us this perspective of like this outsider perspective of this would really fly here. Why don't we try it? So I think it was, I guess, just over a year ago. We decided to do a similar project, and we called it Found Forgotten Food. Based sort of on the idea of Hidden Harvest, which is collecting fruit from fruit trees, but it sort of evolved to more about agricultural production. So getting the food that's left over on farms after the harvest, because there's a lot of food left over on farms after their commercial harvest for whatever reason. It could be that the mechanical harvesters just aren't very great at picking up everything in the field, which is totally true.
It's human nature. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's, so when you go through with your mechanical harvester, it's really quick, but it, you know, your mechanical machine can't recognize, oh, I left 5 potatoes behind. I'm going to turn around and get those 5 potatoes.
Yeah. They will soon, though.
They will, maybe they will, and then this organization will be not needed anymore. So it could be a mechanical problem. It could be that, you know, the market is just saturated with whatever it is. So we've talked to farmers that were like, hey, I planted all this kale, and everyone else planted a whole bunch of kale, and I can't sell all my kale at the market now because just everybody is selling kale, and there's only so much kale that people want to buy.
Which is a shame.
Which is a shame, right?
Yeah.
And so we collect food from farmers' fields afterwards, obviously with their permission. Yeah. We collect
food. It's not a rogue operation.
It's not a rogue operation. We collect food from farmers' markets at the end of a market day, and then we collect food from people's backyards. So if you have a backyard garden and you produce a lot of food and you're not going to eat it all, you can donate it to us. So in our first season, which was last summer, so summer 2016, we collected over 3,300 pounds of fresh local produce that would have otherwise gone to waste, and we donated the vast majority of it to food banks and community groups and shelters and library programs for kids, places that really appreciated that food. So it has gone so well since we started. When we started, it was funny. We finished our master's. There was a brief period of time where we were like, we can do this and the master's at the same time. And then that lasted for like 2 weeks. Yeah. And we were like, no, we can't do that. That's impossible. So we finished our master's, and then we were like, we're just going to put this together really slowly and take our time and get it all set up. And then somehow or another, one of the local papers in Halifax called The Coast found out about us and wanted to do a story on us and said, hey, we want to interview about your cool idea. And we were like, oh, we haven't done anything yet, so I don't know what this interview is going to be about. But once we had that interview, then it all really snowballed, and we've had so much support. Right now we have over 170 casual volunteers on our sign-up list. Wow. We have 7 core volunteer members. We're all volunteer right now, Lindsay and myself included. So everyone's working on a volunteer basis. 3,300 pounds of food in our first season. And I will say that that first season was using 2 personal vehicles there. We just loaded it all up with squash and stuff. In March, just this past March, we were donated a truck.
Whoa!
Which is great. Yes. Partially because I think people were feeling sorry that sedans were being full of squash. And we just recently, on the past weekend, had a fundraiser where we raised $3,700 to buy a trailer for the truck so we can haul even more produce. So I think this season we'll be able to get quite a bit more, because there was a lot of instances where we would go and load up literally like floor to ceiling the cars with squash or whatever it was, and say, well, that's actually all we can take. We can't take anymore, but there's still so much in the field, which is such a shame, right? Yeah. Because the food bank or wherever we're going, we'll really appreciate that. So now that we have more capacity, we'll be able to collect more and donate more.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's cool. Like, I love, as a business guy, I love the fact that it goes from an idea to like results.
Yeah.
Like that is like amazing. And such a quick time frame, right? Like that's so cool. Like, you and Lindsay had an idea. Let's try this out. And boom, 3,300 pounds of food. And this is not like crap. Like, this is not a McDonald's food. Like, this is like vegetables. I'm assuming mostly vegetables or
mostly vegetables, some fruit.
Yeah.
It's really impactful for the places that we donate. And this is the reason. All volunteer. When we first brought our first donation, which was a big batch of rhubarb, we brought it to the food bank. And not all food banks will take fresh produce either. I should mention that. Yeah. So you have to select where you're going, because they don't have the infrastructure.
Yeah.
But we brought it to the food bank, and the woman who received it at the food bank, who was a volunteer of the food bank, started to cry.
Did you cry?
Obviously, I cry all the time.
I know, you have to say,
I'm such an easy crier.
I'm almost.
I think I've cried at every single event that we have, and Lindsay will verify that. But she started to cry, and the reason is all of the produce that they get, really, like I would say like 99%, is produce from grocery stores that is like on the best before day, or like maybe just one day before the best before day, but it's being donated because no one's buying it anymore.
Yeah.
So it's food that like has to have an extremely fast turnaround, otherwise it's gonna go bad too.
Yeah.
And so they're getting this food that is fine to eat, but it's not fresh, it's not super, you know, it's not at the peak of its prime, right? Yeah. Whereas we're going to a farm, we're picking it off that farm and bringing it 2 hours later to the food bank. So they're
fairly fresh.
Fairly fresh, right? We've still got dirt on our knees from picking it. So they will never get that really, other than what we're doing.
Yeah.
Because a lot of what they get is grocery stores or wherever donating it because, oh, it's about to go bad. I guess we should just donate it.
Which is better than nothing.
Which is totally better than nothing.
But I think overall, like, again, and I've been lucky. I've never had to go to a food bank. But if I had to go to a food bank, I'd rather get some nice local produce versus some lettuce that's going to go bad tomorrow from Argentina.
Right. And it creates this sort of, you know, food banks are already flying by the seat of their pants because there's a lot of demand for them. But it just creates this additional strain for them when they're getting huge donations of, and I'll give this example, this happened last summer, huge donations of strawberries in the plastic clamshell containers that, you know, one third of the strawberries in every container are already rotted. Right. And so we had gone to the food bank and we were donating something or other. And they were like, hey, do you have any need for these strawberries? Because we just really don't have the time to pick through every single one of these strawberry containers to get rid of the rotten ones. Like, we just don't have time to do that. We have other fish to fry here. Like, so we took those strawberries, and it's a little counterintuitive taking food from the food bank. But we were able to take those strawberries and do workshops. With those strawberries, we froze them and then do workshops on how to make your own preserves and how to can and keep your food longer.
Strawberry and rhubarb together.
I know.
Marriage.
So we were able to have this kind of symbiotic relationship where we created that jam, we were able to sell it, and then the money that we then generated from that jam allows us to continue bringing food to that same food bank. Yeah. So it was this really nice circular process.
Very similar to the Parkdale Food Center. I don't know if you follow that stuff in Ottawa, but they're doing some really cool stuff, very similar to what they're doing. They're involving kids in producing pesto for time and again, and then next thing you know, then they're selling it, and then the money goes back, and they're doing food towers now.
Yeah.
And I think they're trying to put 100 of them in throughout the city for 150 of them for the 150th. So,
yeah, there's a similar organization in Halifax called Hope Blooms. I don't know if you've heard of them.
No.
They were on Dragon's Den a few years ago, and they're like killing it. But they do their own salad dressings out of food that they've grown out of Uniac Square, and now it's in Sobeys throughout the Maritimes, I'm pretty sure. So they're doing really well. So it's just getting people more involved with food. And I think there is this, you know, I've said this before, I like to say that like the success of Found is because Lindsay and I and all of our volunteers are just so great. But I honestly don't think that's the entire reason. I think we came into the right space at the right time and people were like, yeah, we really do need this. This is a great cause. And it's something that I think everyone can kind of get behind, right? Like, food waste is bad. No one's going to say food waste is a good thing and we should just continue to waste our food.
Yeah.
So it's something that it's really easy to convince and have people support us, I guess. It's not very controversial.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a great jump off point. I want to thank you. I know you're a busy lady and you'll be teaching a little bit more today and probably spending some time at the library and doing all this stuff and probably picking up some produce at some point as well. I really appreciate your time. I always enjoy our chats. And where can people find you on the socials?
On the socials? Well, you can find Found Forgotten Food on Instagram, Facebook, and our website. So our website is www.foundns.com. Found Forgotten Food on Facebook, Found Forgotten Food on Instagram, and Found NS on Twitter.
Okay.
And if folks want to connect with me, I also have my own website, and it's www.laurelshoot.com.
Okay. And I'll link all this in the show notes. And one thing I almost forgot, what does wellness mean to you?
Oh, goodness.
I know. This is tough. It's not a free interview. You got to work.
Wow.
You got to work for it.
Yeah, this is a tough ending. Okay. What does wellness mean to me? Wellness is the ability to reflect and be mindful of what it is that you truly need in the moment, not what it is that you think you should do. Wellness has no space for shoulds in my books. And so being mindful and aware of what you really need without what you think you should be doing. I don't know, that's kind of cryptic.
Yeah, I like it. Again, thank you so much for your time, and look forward to maybe doing a part two down the road, where especially after you've had another season of success with Found NS. So we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Wellness Wednesdays. I'm your host, Eric Clard. Until next week, be well.